What I'm going to be talking about today is, and thank you for arranging the beautiful weather, by the way. That's quite an amazing achievement for a conference chair. I spent the first few years of my career, post-PhD career, doing data integration. And then a few years after that, I was trying to leave data integration to do something else. Now I'm at the stage where I no longer apologize anymore for doing data integration, because it's such a huge problem, and I think I can spend my entire career doing it, and I'll just have, I'll relax and have a good time about it. So what I want to talk about today is, I called it a status report, but it's more a little bit of what's been done in the past and where I think things should be going. Now, I'm not going to be talking, I'm going to be talking mostly about my own work, but I'm going to try to identify certain trends in the research in the community. But this is not going to be, it is impossible, I think, to give a comprehensive survey or talk about data integration. So I'm not going to try it. I'm apologizing for it right now. So I'm going to divide this talk into two parts. The first is about the past, the second about the future. I'm going to try to keep the past short because it's already written, and the future is more exciting. So I'm going to talk about what I think are several areas of research in data integration that are reasonably well understood. That's not to say that these problems are solved. There's still ongoing work. But I think we've learned a lot from these areas, and we're pretty much ready to move on. And then I'll talk about what I think are the big challenges, or at least the challenges in my group, going forward, and where I see a lot of the action being. So first, let me give you this generic data integration slide that to make sure that we're all on the same page, knowing what data integration is. So basically, data integration is are systems that try to give you a uniform access to a set of possibly many data sources. Okay, so here, this is the generic example. Actually, this is the .com example. I should find something else already. But so here, you're looking at a company who has several databases, like a shipping database, an order database, and all these databases were actually designed independently of each other. The people never knew that they would have to talk to the people in the other department. And all of a sudden, things happened. The web happened. Business intelligence happened. And what you want to do, or as a CEO, or as a customer of the company, you want to be able to query all these data sources as if they're one database. Okay? And so, so the question is how to do that, and that's what data integration systems are here to solve. Now, what I want to emphasize is that I'm not actually showing an architecture here, but the kind of data integration I'm talking about mostly is what's called virtual integration, where you leave the data at the data sources, and you have some mediated schema. This is you create a schema that is not really populated with any data. It's a bunch of relations or XML or whatever you want it to be, and when you query it, there's some smarts going on in the system, and the system takes your query and sends it to the underlying data sources. But what I want to emphasize is that this is only one possible architecture for data integration. And so when you actually go there, when you leave the university and you go to the business world and you talk about data integration, they have many, many other architectures that they have in mind. In fact, you know, up to 3 years ago, if you talked to people about data integration in industry, it basically meant data warehousing. Okay, but today there is things like messaging systems and B2B and web services, and all these things are trying to achieve very similar things. But what I want to mostly talk about the virtual data integration systems today. Okay, so again, a few years ago when I used to talk about this, I used to have all these nice examples about why we want to do data integration, and this was the point in the talk where I sort of looked at people and I said, I hope they believe me when I tell them that this is a really important problem. And usually they did. But now I know, okay? Now I can actually say this with confidence. People really need data integration out there. And so what I did here was I list the four major sources of applications for data integration. They're listed in a particular order. The order is where the money is coming from, okay? Where you have more chance of making money. The inverse order is sort of how noble the application is, okay? So this is a lesson that you learn pretty quickly. So basically, you go into every company, and they have a lot of databases, And you tell them, you know, they tell you about their data integration needs, and they're pretty serious about it. Sometimes they call it customer relationship management. They have, like AT&T, they have, you know, many customers. Some are wireless, some are usual customers for phone customers, some are credit card customers. And what do you know, you want to be able to treat them in a uniform way. The government, you don't know what's going on in the government, and you know what, they don't know what's going on in the government because there are so many data sources, and unfortunately after September 2001, all of a sudden they want to know what's going on, and so they're putting a lot of efforts into data integration. The examples that got me working on data integration were having to do with integrating data sources on the web. Okay, these examples haven't gone away. They're still there. They're actually, there are a lot of applications that do use these things. And of course, being at a university, sometimes what I call the real scientists come to your office and tell you about all their integration needs, if it's astronomers or biomedical researchers and stuff like that. So they all need data integration. Now, so there are a huge number of data integration projects in the research community. It is impossible to give a list of these projects without insulting anybody. So instead, what I'm doing is I'm insulting everybody equally and listing only my projects. So the information manifold that Gerhard mentioned earlier and a couple of systems that I built at the University of Washington. Now, I'll talk more about companies a little later, but the bottom line is there are quite a few startups. Very, very few of them are still in business. But the important thing is that the big companies are starting to talk about data integration, and so they're seeing the need. Or they're seeing the money, I guess. Okay. So the areas, and please stop me with questions at any point. I mean, happy to take questions. So I'm going to talk about, very, very briefly, about four areas where I think progress has been made. These are mediation languages for specifying relationships between data sources and mediated schemas, query processing in data integration in XML, and I'll talk a little bit about what I learned from the commercial world, but it's going to be very brief. The lessons are not very encouraging. Okay, so let me first talk about mediation languages. So here, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? The problem is you have a set of data sources. Okay, they're the data sources that actually hold the data. Okay, and you have the schema that the user is going to use in order to post queries over these data sources. So this is the schema that the user is using for when they talk about data, when they try to use your data integration system. And the question is, how do you specify the relationship between the schemas of the data sources and the schemas and the mediated schema? And as you can see, I learned how to use animations recently, and they work. So now I have to stand here. So the idea is that the goal, what this language should enable you to do, is that when you get a query over the mediated schema, that the system will translate it into a set of queries over the data sources, and somehow the data will be collected. Every data source will get a particular query, and the data will come back to the mediator, and somehow will be combined and presented to the user. Okay, so that's what this language is trying to achieve. And there have been two major sets of languages that have been proposed for doing this mediation. One is called I don't know where these names come from. But one is called Globalist View, the other is called, the one is called Localist View. Okay, so we call them GAV and LAV. And the first one is sort of the obvious thing you would think about. In fact, it's been around since the beginning of the 80s from the multibase system. And the idea is that if you have a set of relations in the data sources, then the mediated schema should just be a set of views over these relations. Okay, so here, for example, my favorite example is using titles of the movie database. Okay, so you have titles and actors and stuff like that and whatever. And so what you would have is you'd have a set of relations in the mediated schema that talks about titles and actors in movies, and you would define, for example, the relation actor as a view over the data sources. Okay? So in this case, it probably would be a union of certain relations, and maybe you'd have to take out, you'd have to do a little bit of data transformation, or you'd have to do some projections and selections over the data sources. Okay? So now if you get a query over the mediated schema, then all you need to do is essentially view unfolding, and you have your query over the data sources. Okay? The other approach, which is slightly closer to my heart, is what's called localized view. And here, this was inspired by the idea that if you're going to map, if you're going to have a system that has access to many data sources, meaning more than five, okay, then you can't always, when you look at the mediated schema, trying to define it as a union of all kinds of data sources, where in some cases you need to join these two data sources, and in another case you need to join these two other data sources and take unions, that's going to be too complicated. So instead, the idea of localized view is to describe each data source in isolation. Okay? So instead of describing the mediated schema as a view over the set of data sources, each data source is described as a view over the mediated schema. So in a sense, what you're doing here is you're describing what is in the data source without actually caring about what's in the other data sources. Okay? So for example, here you might have source R1 here might be, for example, a join over the title and actor relation. And in fact, you might restrict it to movies that were produced after 1970. Okay? So, so you can actually focus on each data source when you describe it. So that's what localized view is. And the main advantage of localized view, as I said, is you don't have to consider the other data sources. And you can specify in more, in finer detail, what is in every data source. Now, when you actually get a query on the mediated schema here, then what you need to do in order to answer the query is what we call answering queries using views, which is a subject that has been studied, quote, to death over the last few years. There's a survey in the VLDB journal about it, and there's still papers being written. It's not a completely solved problem. So obviously, if you have localized view and you have globalized view, you try to combine them, and so you have this acronym soup, and it's called GLAV, because if you're stuck with GAV and LAV, then there's not much you can do. And there's nothing terribly hard about GLAV than there is in LAV. Okay, so moving right along here. So I think, again, we have a set of tools now that we can describe relationships between data sources and mediated schemas. We pretty much understand them. We pretty much understand how to do reformulation. We can move on now. So the next thing is how do we actually process queries in a data integration system? And the observation here was that that unlike a database system where you have statistics over your data sources and you have pretty much control over what's happening in the system, you can't do that in data integration because first of all, the data is not under your control. You don't have statistics. You don't have the data is coming over the network, so there are all kinds of things that are happening in the middle that may cause certain query plans that look good initially to look very, very bad all of a sudden. And so you can't follow the usual paradigm, the sort of the system R paradigm of let's create a query execution plan and then execute it, okay? So people started working on, this is a whole sub-community here, started working on what's called adaptive query processing. In fact, they invented adaptive query processing, and then they saw that in Ingress in 1976, the idea was already mentioned. So it's, you sort of invent the wheel, reinvent the wheel, and then you find it in previous literature. Adaptive query processing wasn't invented for the sole purpose of data integration. It just started getting a little more attention because of data integration. In fact, Goetz and a student of his already talked about choose nodes in, I believe, 1993 or 94, where in the plan, you have a bunch of choices that you can make at runtime, depending on what the data is looking like, and so you're not following a single plan. Dave DeWitt and a student of his in 98 also had a scheme where after, at a materialization point, you materialize a subresult, you can now look at the plan again and decide maybe you'll change what you're doing. So then I had a student, his name is Zach Ives, and he just graduated last year, and he's a professor now at the University of Pennsylvania. And he developed a scheme called convergent query processing. What convergent query processing does is, so if you look at the previous techniques in adaptive query processing, what they do is they each treat a certain aspect of the problem in isolation. So for example, if you want to re-optimize after materialization point, that's fine. But if getting to the materialization point already cost you a lot of wasted time, then the benefits that you can get from that are limited. Okay, or there's been some stuff on query scrambling by Mike Franklin and his students, where they try to reschedule things in a plan depending on how the data is arriving from the network. That's a great technique, but it's limited to rescheduling based on certain events. So what Zach tried to do was try to look at a more comprehensive approach where he can adapt to anything. Okay, so what he does is he starts with a query plan that he computes out of, if you have some statistics or otherwise you take the usual system R guesses, and he starts executing. And he monitors the execution, and as the data is coming in, he's looking at what are the characteristics of the data compared to what the plan is based on, or what is the justification for the plan. And when he sees that the data isn't what he thought it would be, or the plan thought it would be, he switches to a different plan. Okay, now he does this in a way that doesn't waste the previous work that's been done. So he takes all the intermediate results and he leaves them there, okay, and he moves to a next phase of execution. Okay, so he doesn't reread all the data. Okay, so now, and then he goes on, and after a while, the system sort of, that's why it's called convergent, and converges to what seems like the best plan. Okay, so it's in every phase, he's reading a new segment of the data out of the that is coming in. He's improving his plan. And at the end, he has what's called a cleanup phase, where he needs to do all the cross. He needs to take the data from phase one and join it with data from phase two to make sure that he gets the correct result. Okay, so, and again, so he shows that that using convergent query processing, he can actually encompass a lot of previous techniques and suggest new ones. But the interesting thing to me about convergent query processing is that you can be much more aggressive in the optimizations that you use. Okay, so for example, when you're trying to commute to take group by and putting them before joins, optimizations like that, the query processor is never quite sure that this is a good idea. With convergent query processing, you can try. Okay, at the worst case, you'll have one phase that isn't going so well, but then you will converge to a better plan. Okay, so you can be much more aggressive about the optimizations that you actually do in during query processing. Okay, the next area is XML query processing, and I'm actually not going to talk much about this. There are people in this room that are much more qualified to talk about than I am. In fact, there's a whole conference that is dedicated to XML. It's called SIGMOD. No, that's not quite true. There is only about 80 submissions to Sigma this year were about XML. There were 200 submissions about other stuff. To be fair, going forward to looking at the commercial world, I think the area of XML query processing was the one that had so far most impact on the commercial product. And furthermore, XML query processing is also the area where I think innovation came from the companies. Okay, not only the established companies, but also the startup companies. Okay, so first of all, people realize that XML facilitates integration. So if you have your data already in XML, you can translate it into XML, then you can do integration slightly more easier than it is before. And so there are a couple of companies that built data integration systems built based on XML, okay? And so they had to actually, and since they were started in the late 90s, I should say, they had to invent everything because there wasn't too much published about how to process XML. And so so today I think we have some reasonably well-performing XML query processors, and I list here some of the areas that that progress has been made in. And again, there's a lot of work. I'm looking, I see Donald Kaufman here. They developed in XQRL, one of the nicest XQuery processors that that are out there. So let me talk a little bit about the commercial world. I should stress that my, as Gerhard was saying, the smart thing that I did in the beginning of founding Nimble was two things. One is I hired good management, so I could get out of the way because I realized very quickly that I'm not a person who's designed to be a manager in a company. And the second thing I did was I worked hard at the university so I can maintain my job there. Okay, so even though the economy went down, I still have a job. Now, so the reason Nimble is so there are a set of companies, and again, it's impossible to list all the data integration companies. What you're seeing here is the companies that I know about on the west coast of the United States. Okay, that's the coverage that I'm aware of. The reason Nimble is in green is because when I talk now, Nimble is the only company I actually know what I'm talking about. The other things are things that I hear from rumors sitting in boardrooms and with venture capitalists that look and read their email on during the meeting and say, oh, you know, this is happening there. But a bunch of other companies, Enosys is a company in San Diego founded by Yannis Papakonstantinou and his crowd. And the other two are Metamatrix and Calixa that are actually relational companies. So they're integrating at the SQL level. Nimble and Enosys are XML integrations. Now, so these are the startups. I won't tell you about all their problems having to do with the fact that the stock market has crashed and a bunch of other things have happened. But I mean, Nimble is alive. It's selling product. It's got a nice product actually, and it's got customers like Boeing and a bunch of big truck companies. I don't know if truck companies need data integration. The interesting thing I think that is happening now is that the big guys are making, you know how they sell. They tell you that, sorry, Goats, I'm going to make a few jokes here about Microsoft, but actually, there are people from IBM. I'm going to even make worse jokes about them. So what a big company does is they tell you that you know they're going to ship a data integration company in a few months, and the CEO makes the announcement, and then a bunch of people at a technical level start scrambling and say, what did he really mean? What is data integration? We need to figure this out, and we only have 3 months until we need to release a product, and they start panicking. So this is actually true mostly of VA. So then they start, and I'm making jokes about VA, this is really bad. Anyway, so what they're seeing is they're seeing that there's a need for data integration, there's an activity, little companies are actually getting traction, and so they're starting to look and figure out what they're gonna do. So for example, IBM announced that Esperanto is available as a data integration system. BEA announced Liquid Data about a year before anybody could actually buy Liquid Data. Today you can buy it. Microsoft, still trying to figure things out. There are a lot of interesting things. There are many groups in Microsoft that are all looking at different aspects of integration, and hopefully they'll figure it out soon. Oracle, no. Oracle says no. We don't need data integration. We have integration. Just buy Oracle. That's your integration, okay? So it just depends on how arrogant your CEO is, okay? So here's what I think is the main area of progress that we made. 3 years ago, when you started a company on data integration, you went to talk to people, they didn't know what that means. They thought it was data warehousing. Of course, we do data integration. What do you mean? We take all the data, we put it in a warehouse, and it's integrated. Okay, and if you say that you need to get to recent data, then you say, well, we have real-time databases, real-time data warehousing. What does that mean? They don't know. So I think the progress that we've made in one of the progress that we made in the last few years is that if you look at the analysts are people who they look at the business world, they write these reports. They're a little bit like reviewers in the academic world, except they actually get paid for what they do, unlike us that we just do this. We don't have anything to do over winter vacation, so we review papers for Sigmund. So these people now have a buzzword. They actually have a category. It's called EII, Enterprise Information Integration, and they talk about these companies. They talk about what that is. They talk about leaving the data where it is and querying it at query time. And whereas a few years ago they thought that this is a horrible idea because how could this ever perform, now they actually think that this is actually a reasonable idea, and there are actually products out there. So what are the challenges that are faced today by data integration companies? One is integration with other buzzwords. So EAI is enterprise application integration. And the basic difference between EII and EAI is that EII only queries, EAI actually does stuff, okay? So, you know, it moves money from here to there and purchase orders. And the question is, as a customer, when you need to solve a problem, you have some of that and you have some of this, and as a customer you're looking and you're looking to buy one product that'll solve your problem, okay? Whereas as a company, you have a solution, you have a platform on which you can solve a lot of problems, okay? So it's a different perspective between the customer and between the company and the customer. The customer wants to solve a problem, the company wants to sell a certain platform, okay? And this gets very, very hairy because when you talk to these companies or these customers, there are a million products that they can buy all in the area of middleware. Middleware is the most confusing term or the most confusing space that you can imagine, okay? There are so many products there. The relationships between them are, I try, every few months I say, okay, I'm gonna figure it out. I go, I talk to people at Nimble and they tell me, I lose interest after 2 hours. I just can't figure out the space. So, but the problem is there are a lot of products out there. There are a lot of different, you know, problems that people are trying to solve over the layer of databases, and the customer is confused, okay? And in order to get a customer, you need to solve a particular problem. You have to come and tell them that you have a solution to their problem, especially in this market today where unless you have a solution to their problem and their problem is, you know, their job depends on this, on solving this problem, they're not gonna buy, okay? So this is one of the big challenges that are being faced. One, you know, if you look at companies like Business Objects, all these companies that are doing the analytics over the data, also they need to analyze your data. Okay, they need to create reports, crystal reports, all these, and they need to integrate the data. So that's another middleware, okay, that is looking at your data, but now you want to look at it through the data integration system. So how do you figure all that out and make it simple for the customer to do? The other thing that we found a lot at Nimble was how do you sell data integration? Do you do this horizontally or vertically? So there have been a couple of companies that came and said, okay, we're going to solve a particular problem in the financial domain. Okay, we're going to talk to companies like Merrill Lynch and Citibank and whatever. And here's the problem that we're going to solve. Yes, you need a data integration system in there, and we're going to hype that up. We're going to talk a lot about data integration, but the product is solving a particular problem for the financial domain, okay? Whereas at the horizontal approach, you say, okay, we have a data integration system. It's not like when you sell databases, you say, I'm going to sell a database for a bank. No, I'm selling a database because it's a general set of operations that you want to use to manipulate some data. And so you can do the same thing with data integration, okay? And so the question is, should you, as a company or as an industry, should we specialize in particular verticals and try to sell to particular customers, or can we create a wide platform that is applicable to many problems? And this has been a struggle every 2 months, I mean, in any company. Should we focus or should we do a horizontal? And usually the problem was that everybody said, yeah, sure. If we can figure out the vertical that will get us, you know, $1 million a month, we'll do it. But you can't do that unless you know enough about the vertical in order to make that to bet your company on something like that. Okay, so this has been and will probably continue to be a struggle for companies. Okay, so got to talk about the future faster than I thought. So let me move on to what I think are some areas that are of interest right now. So the first one is what we call pure data management. And here it's actually a very simple generalization of data integration systems. So, and again, this is coming from some experience talking to customers about what they actually want to do when they share data. The nice thing about data integration systems was that you can leave the data where it is, and all you need to do is create the central mediated schema through which everybody will query. Okay? The problem is that mediated schema is still hard to create. It's still a central effort. So if you, in many integration environments, you don't even want to create a central mediated schema that has logic that logically models all of your data. Okay? What you want is a much more distributed way of sharing data without even the logical centralization that a mediated schema gives you. Okay? So peer data management systems are basically a generalization of data integration systems. So any application that is good for data integration will be good for peer data management and more. Okay? And what the idea here that is that you have a set of peers, and each peer can do one of three things. It can either have actually export some data, or it can be a middleman. It's like just a logical translator between a bunch of data sources. Or it might provide some views. It might just be a cache of other data or views over other data. Okay? And the semantic relationships, instead of being specified between a mediated schema and a set of data sources, now they're specified locally between usually two peers at a local level. So here is an example of what you might, so this is sort of similar to an example that we actually have running at the University of Washington. So we're actually building a system, I should say, truth in advertisement here, okay? We have a system called Piazza that is looking into building peer data management systems. And something like this is running in our lab. So suppose here you have a set of peers, okay? So you identify the ones on the bottom, and suppose you have a bunch of universities in the US and a bunch of very, very useful data sources like DDLP and Sightseer. Okay, now what you do is you specify the logical relationships locally between pairs of peers, okay? So now when you get a query, then a query, for example, at Zollbrücken, you will that query will be translated to two queries on Zollbrücken's immediate neighbors, and those will get translated into queries further on in the network. Okay, and the thing to notice here that you might have multiple ways of getting from a node to another node. Okay, so this is a graph of peers rather than being just a tree or anything. Okay, so. So what are the main advantages of peer data management systems? One is that the big thing, and that's why it's in red, is that you don't need a mediated schema. You can design, you have schemas locally, and you just map locally between data sources, okay? And because of that, you can, where in a data integration system you had to map to the mediated schema, here you can map to whoever you want to map, okay? So the guys in Berlin can map to the guys in Leipzig, and they don't have to worry about everybody else going on. Okay, it's a much easier mapping than you map opportunistically. The other nice thing is when you pose a query on your own schema. You don't pose a query on somebody else's schema. So it's hard enough to pose a query on your own schema. You don't want to have to learn somebody else's schema to do that. Some people are talking about this thing called the semantic web. Tim Berners-Lee and his army are talking about this, having conferences about this. And the idea of the semantic web is that you have a web of data sources, and they sort of, everything works magically using AI techniques. You can answer all kinds of queries. So when Gerhard in the beginning said that he's not gonna say anything embarrassing about me, I was thankful because otherwise I thought he would mention my AI career, and I didn't want that to happen here. So basically what I'm trying to say is that a peer data management system actually provides an architecture for sharing data in a large-scale web environment, if you want, okay? Now, a warning, this is, when you talk about a peer data management system, if you don't want your papers to be rejected, then you should be very clear. You should have a paragraph in the introduction saying that this is not a P2P file sharing system, okay? Say that in the introduction before they reject the paper, okay? Because then all kinds of things happen when people start thinking about peer-to-peer file sharing. The differences are, first of all, the data has rich semantics. It's not just files moving around. And the second is membership is not as dynamic as it is in a P2P file sharing system, okay? You're not gonna be sitting on your beach, opening your laptop, expecting all of a sudden this database to be created on the beach to be part of a global community. Okay, and I should say, I'm talking about Piazza, but there are actually several systems, several other research groups looking at pure data management system. One is in Fausto Gincigia's group in Italy, and another is in Toronto, and another is in Singapore. So we're pretty well distributed over the globe. Okay, so let me briefly talk about what are the research challenges here. So the first thing is, okay, the same schema mediation, okay, can we do it? And the idea, the challenge here is that instead of having a mediated schema and a set of data sources, now you have this graph of peers, okay? Can you just take the languages that we know and love from data integration and apply them in a setting like this? So surprise, surprise, there are a bunch of subtleties, okay? You have to be careful about the structure of the network and what formulas you put in every place. And I'm not gonna tell you much about this. You can go to India next week and hear all about it. And when you start sharing XML data, then the languages become a little different, and you can go to Budapest, hear about that. So let me talk about something more interesting. The question now is really query optimization. Can you do it, okay? So the problem here is that when you get a query at Saarbrücken, then first of all, there's a lot of reformulation to do. You're trying to reformulate the query over its neighbors and then over its other neighbors and so on and so forth. So you might have a very expensive query reformulation phase before you get any answers. So you can interleave query reformulation execution, but still you might pay a lot in query reformulation. The other problem is that you might be following a lot of redundant paths. So if the structure of the network is very ad hoc, you might be doing a lot of extra work that you don't need to do if you know a little bit more about the structure of the network. Finally, if you reformulate at runtime, then the plans that you're actually getting might not be very optimal. You're getting just the same way we try to unnest queries in a relational system and unfold views. You're going to get better plans if you can actually look at the entire query in the beginning and then find the best plan for it. So one possible solution is that for certain paths in the network, you might try to pre-compose them. So you might say, you know, I'm going a lot between Saarbrücken and Stanford. Why don't I just pre-compose the mappings between those two sources, okay? Now, you don't want to do this everywhere because otherwise you're going to have way too many paths to follow. But so in some cost-based fashion, you'll decide that certain paths will be pre-composed. So we thought this is a good idea, and one of my really smart students, Giant Madhavan, we started working on this, and I told him, okay, why don't you figure out the algorithm for the composition, and tomorrow we'll meet again, and we'll figure out how to use it in a pure data management system, okay? So that was in the end of the spring last year, and we ended up spending all the entire summer and fall just on that thing that he was supposed to finish, you know, for breakfast at the end of spring. And so he came back the next day and he said, I'm gonna come later. So he came back 2 days later and he said, look, there's a problem here. And he showed me two simple mappings, okay, between, you know, source A and B and B and C. And he said, you know, if we compose them, then the composition will be an infinite set of formulas. Okay, so this composition thing isn't as trivial as we thought. We're not gonna be able to finish this before lunch. So the theoretician in me said, great, okay, we have something cool to work on here. And so we started proving theorems, and I wanted Giant to prove a few theorems. So we started looking into this. And so even though in general, when you compose two mappings, the composition might be infinite, we were able to prove that for a very common set of queries, those called CQK, that only have K variables of at every level of nesting, they only have K variables, you can actually show that you can take this infinite set of formulas and encode it in a finite way, okay? Which is already good news, and encoding a finite way is good. First of all, in many cases, you can actually do this, and it will be a finite composition. And when it's infinite, you can actually encode it in a finite way. And so in many cases, you can actually precompose certain paths and optimize them so you can, at runtime, you actually get some benefits. So this is an interesting set of results that we spent the summer on. Another issue that arises in pure data management systems is how do you manage updates? So in fact, there's been relatively little talk about management of updates in data integration systems. In fact, the customers ask about it all the time. So you go there and you tell them, okay, I can query all your data sources. And they said, but what if I want to change my data sources? Well, you give them some sort of story, and then you know that a data integration company is hyping things up when they tell you that they can update the data sources. Okay, it sounds fishy. So what can you do here? The problem in a pure data management system is that you don't even know in a data integration system. At least you know where the mediator is. In a pure data management system, you have an update to your data. You don't even know who's accessed your data, right? You don't even know where the data went. Okay, so what we do in Piazza is we represent updates as first-class citizens, and we publish them in the network the same way we publish data. Okay, and now what we do is we have a set of rules that enables you to use updates in order to propagate the updates into other data sources. Okay, and again, there are a variety of architectures that you might want to consider here, which is why the rules that we're looking at are sort of designed to be pretty generic and deal with a set of architectures. Okay, so when we started working on Piazza, there's like a long list of interesting problems that you can work on here. The first thing we did was obviously we wrote a grant to the National Science Foundation. We got a lot of money. We started working, and we were happy. Okay, so that's where we are. Okay, so now let me talk about. Probably what is the most important problem in data integration of any kind, okay? And it's actually incredibly appropriate that I speak about schema matching here in Leipzig, because Erhard Rahm and his students have been doing some beautiful work on this topic. So what is the problem? The problem is the age-old problem, right? There was God created the world, then he created the first database, and he created the second database, and after that, databases had to start talking to each other, right? Schema matching problem. So you have a pair of schemas, okay, that were designed without knowing that they'll ever, you know, need to interoperate. And this can be schemas, this can be DTDs. If you're giving this talk in an AI audience, you talk about ontologies. It's all the same thing, okay? You might have some data that comes with this database, okay? And you might have some additional domain knowledge. So you're talking about purchase orders, and you know certain things about purchase orders that help you. And what you want to do is you want to find a way of interoperating between these two schemas. Okay. So usually what people have done is look at this problem in two stages. In the first stage, you look at the two schemas. You're looking at the two schemas, and you want to come up with a set of what's called a schema match. It's a set of correspondences between the two schemas. You're going to say that, look, the term address here sort of corresponds to location there. What does that mean? That means that ultimately you're going to write some sort of what's called a semantic mapping, which is actually a query expression that shows you how to take data from here and translate it into data over there. And that correspondence is sort of going to be part of one of these formulas. Okay. So the first stage is coming up with a match. And the second stage is taking that match with a domain expert and trying to come up with an actual query expressions that map between one data source and another data source. So there's been a lot of activity on both of them. The Clio project at IBM is actually the one that innovates most in the phase of coming up with the actual mappings. Okay, so I'm going to talk mostly about schema matching. So this is an example, so you might have here, this is what's called a one-to-one match. All these mappings should be matches. Between address and location, so these are two DTDs of house listings. You might have what's called a non-one-to-one match, where you have the number of baths here is the sum of the number of full baths and half baths. And you might have some questionable mappings, like view in one talks about water view in another. You know, what does that mean? Okay, it's like when you try to buy a house in Las Vegas. What does it mean when they say water view? It means that they see the neighbor's pool. I mean, whereas in Seattle, you have standards. Okay, so some matches are never going to be quite, you know, quite accurate. So I can motivate the problem of schema matching until everybody weeps here, but I'm not going to do that. The point is that whenever you do data sharing of any kind, whether it's virtual data integration, whether it's data warehousing, whether it's web services, whenever two data sources interact with each other in some way, if they don't understand each other, then there's no, you can move the bits between the systems as efficiently as you want. If they don't understand what they are, then it's useless. There has been, I'd call it, recent interest in model management, championed by Phil Bernstein at Microsoft, where the idea is to come up with an algebra where you manipulate models of data and mappings between models of data as first-class citizens, and try to make it easier to perform metadata tasks. Instead of doing it in code, you do it using a simple algebra. The paper by Sergey and Erhard and Phil at Sigma 2003 is actually the first complete model management system that's ever been made. So this thing is actually this area of model management is getting a lot of really good work lately. And right now, and the point of this is that in model management, a key operator is how to match between models. Because once you have a match between models, you can start doing composition, you can start doing application and merging and stuff like that. So right now, if you actually go out there, it's a bottleneck. Schema matching is a bottleneck. People do it by hand, which means they do it wrong, and they charge you a lot of money for it. And so I think it's fair to predict, it's true to predict that there is going to be a lot of interest in this, in schema matching from the commercial world, because what all the companies that I talked about before did was they all know how to move the bits very quickly between different systems. Okay, but now that people can do that, they can move to the next level, and now they're going to really worry about the semantic heterogeneity. Okay. So if you look at, and again, this is an age-old problem in the database community. If you look at, first of all, why is it hard? It's hard because if you look at a schema, you can't just look at a schema and understand what it means. A schema is a set of words, maybe a set of data types. Maybe if they were very generous with you, they wrote a few descriptions in text what this means. But that's very hard to fully understand what's in there. Okay, and if it's hard for a person, then it's certainly hard for a computer program. So if you look at the techniques that were used, then it's essentially what programs have done is anything that a human expert would do. So people started look at attribute names. So if there's an attribute name here that looks like an attribute name there, well, maybe, okay? And they looked at stemming, they looked at n-grams, they looked at all kinds of things. Anything that a human would do. They looked at, oh, I see integers here, I see integers there. They're all in the range of, you know, a few million dollars. That means it must be a house in the Bay Area. So that, you know, they use these kinds of heuristics. They look at relationship between columns, structural similarities in schemas, all these heuristics. So if you look at this, then basically what the research has been doing is they've been trying to do anything that a human expert would do. Okay, so if that's what's going on, then let's take this seriously. Let's see how you can build a robust schema matching system based on these observations. Okay, and I want to emphasize schema matching. The goal of schema matching is never to be completely automated. That's not going to work. Okay, in fact, you can prove a theorem, which is schema matching is AI complete. Okay, if you can solve schema matching, you can solve AI. And And that can be hard. So, so the idea is to try to save a lot of the time, to do a lot of the matching, and to guide the user or the designer or whoever that is to the last parts of the matches to make them as easy as possible. Okay? Because usually when you're looking at a schema, there there might be thousands of elements, and a lot of them are easy to match, but it's you want to be able to focus the attention of the designer on the hard ones. That's the goal here. So, so first of all, what you want to make sure is that a schema matcher combines various techniques in a very, very principled way. Okay? Because there's not going to be one technique that's going to work. There are going to be a set of techniques. And the other thing is that, like human experts, you want to improve over time. Okay? So if you're a consultant and you go do schema matching for companies, after a while, you're pretty good at it. Okay? And you're still charging a lot of money, but you're actually sitting half the time that you're charging on the beach having a good time, okay? Because you're such an expert schema matcher. So what you want to be able to do is you want to learn from experience. The more schemas you see, the more matches you see, that you want to be able to improve, okay? Apparently the key to do that is to get a student from Vietnam, okay? Both Earhart and myself were able to get two very good students from Vietnam with reasonably similar names too. And apparently in Vietnam, schema matching is a big thing, okay? I don't know why. This is the kind of data mining that you get from looking at at too few examples. My student, Anh Hai Doan, who's now a professor at the University of Illinois, developed a system called LSD. We had a problem publishing this name, but it's called Learning Source Descriptions. And the idea there was to, we came from data integration where we're trying to map a set of data sources into a mediated schema. And the idea is let's do the first few mappings manually. Let's learn from that using machine learning techniques and then try to suggest matches for the other data sources. Okay? The COMA system that was developed here at Leipzig did a couple of things. First of all, it had a very, very nice architecture for combining multiple matchers into a matching system. Okay, so you have a set of base matchers, and you combine them into combined predictions. And the other thing that COMA did was, if you've seen matches before for the you're trying to map two schemas, and you've already mapped those schemas to other things, then you try to reuse the library of matches that you've seen in order to improve your matching in the future. Okay, so in recent work with a few people, Phil Bernstein, Microsoft, my student, Jayant Madhavan, and Pradeep Shenoy is another graduate student, and Chen is an undergraduate student. What we're trying to do is take this to an extreme, okay? And the idea here is, let me step back a minute. In the information retrieval literature, or how do IR systems work? They basically work by creating these huge corpora of text, okay? And they do all these very complicated statistical analyses on these texts, and they come up with good matches for you when you're looking for a document, okay? In the natural language community, also a lot of progress in recent years has been based on collecting large corpora of natural language and analyzing them. So the idea here is, suppose you had a huge corpus of schemas. What could you do with it? Okay, and I'll argue later that with a huge corpus of schemas, you can build a set of tools that will make dealing with structured data much, much more easy. So what we're doing is we're trying to take this corpus idea and apply it to schema matching. Okay, and the argument is that if we have a corpus of schemas and matches, we'll be able to do build a much better matching system. Okay, so what we do is we create a corpus, okay, of schemas and matches between these schemas, and now and the particular techniques we're using the fanciest machine learning techniques there are out there, and now when you have two schemas, you look at them and you try to match each one of them into the corpus, try to find elements in the corpus that are similar to the things that you've in the schema. These are schemas that aren't in the corpus. They're new schemas that just were given to you, okay, and you're trying to map them into the corpus. And the idea is that if they map into the same things in the corpus, well, maybe then they also match each other. Okay, so you're trying to exploit the similarity into the corpus to find similarities between these two schemas. Okay, and what this picture is showing you is that first of all, is that we're making progress. Okay, what this is doing is it's comparing the learning. Here we're comparing a corpus of about 10 schemas. So you have a 10 schemas in this shipping domain. Okay, and now you're trying to map to match two new schemas. Okay, and what this is showing you is that even on a corpus of 8 schemas, you're able to learn things that you cannot learn by looking at the two schemas that you're trying to match. Okay, so what this is showing is the recall in the matching between using only the corpus to match between the two schemas versus using basically the techniques that have been known so far to match between these two the two schemas. And what this is showing you that even with a small corpus and without looking at the two schemas that you're matching, you're still getting often very, very competitive rates. Okay, and in fact, what this picture is showing you that is that the all the techniques so far are finding different matches than the matches that are being found by looking at the corpus. Okay, so you're learning from different cues by looking at the schemas that you're matching versus the schemas in the corpus. Okay, and you're learning quite a bit from the corpus. So obviously, this is saying that we need to combine these two and get a better schema matcher. But I think these are very illustrative of what is the power that you can get from the corpus. Okay, so I believe that creating a corpus. First of all, I believe that the whole community should start this huge effort of creating a corpus of a billion schemas and see what we can do with it. Okay, let me make that the one statement that you should take away from this talk. Okay, another possible tool from this tool from using a corpus is suppose you're trying to create a schema for something. Okay, and now you've seen a billion schemas. And you're putting in some data. The some tool that uses the corpus should be able to propose to you a schema that matches your goals. Okay, and this so it's sort of an autocomplete for schemas. Another possible area for this is query reformulation. I come to a set of databases that I know nothing about. I ask a query using I'll even write a SQL query, but using my terminology, and the corpus should be able to take my SQL query and translate it into the appropriate SQL queries into the particular databases. Okay. I also thought that this might be useful for a focused crawling sort of application, like what Gerhard is doing in Bingo. Okay. So. Again, this corpus can have schemas, ontologies, whatever you want. You collect all kinds of statistics about it, and then you build a set of tools. And the first one that we're building is a schema matcher. Okay, so let me conclude here and say data integration is only part of a much broader picture. Okay, whereas we're slowly moving away in the database community between centralized everything, centralized physical control, centralized logical control. We're moving to a network of everything, okay? So the point is that data authoring and querying and data sharing is everywhere, and it's not done by people who are terribly skilled at it anymore. The problem is, and the semantic web is sort of the extreme example of that. The problem is, and there's a whole paper about this, that there's a chasm. When we talk about data sharing, we have the example of the World Wide Web, where everybody shares data. They just write some text, okay? When they want to query, they write a bunch of words. Google does a fine job, okay? When you want to do the same thing with structured data, there's a chasm between the unstructured world and the structured world, okay? In the structured world, it's very hard. You have to create schemas. You have to understand other people's schemas. When you want to do data sharing, you have to come to talks like this and start committees to figure out things, mappings between schemas. It's very hard. And I think, except for the fact that I like to do animations, that one of the biggest challenges here is how, as a community, can we cross this chasm and make it easier? It's never going to be as easy as in the unstructured world, but we need to make it easier for people to deal with structured data, okay? Because more people are going to do it, and there are a lot of applications that need to deal with structured data. So the point of this talk was that a bunch of tools like peer data management systems that distribute the sharing over a lot of nodes, and the corpus of schemas that can yield things like good schema mapping tools. These are all parts of the component, but there's a lot more that needs to go in order to make dealing with structured data much, much easier for everybody. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.